privacy, and it was storm cut, perhaps even the winter before. And it was, I remember it very, very well. It was a little more than waist high, perhaps, and it had, you could see the strata of grass and gravel and sand, or gravel probably predominantly, not sand. And there was also cultural remains, like I remember a big pocket of what appeared to be Arctic hare skulls, or they were hare skulls, and other bones, and then cultural debris, obvious. So when we came up on top, climbed up on top, there was a small boy standing around there. His name was Junior, or Gordon Dimmick Jr., and he was then. Junior was short, but fairly stout kid, and you might have mistaken him for younger than 12, but he was a very alert person. Hell, you ask him if he had anything if he knew anything about digging around this place here, if he had anything. So Junior went back just a short distance to the Dimmick home, maybe 50 yards or less, and quickly came back with a small cardboard box filled with specimens. Hell, you put his hand down into it and pulled out an Aputax specimen. It was the distal end of a Leister prong, or a fish spear. Hey, you told these boys there was a small collection of boys collected around us, and hey, you told them, go over and dig some over there, where Junior found this. So they we walked back eastward to the Black Roadhouse. And the Black Roadhouse was situated just a little west of the Maggots Brothers store. And this part of Deering, in fact, all of Deering, looked like a mixture of an Eskimo village and the leftovers of the gold rush. The Maggots store was... And another building down the way, which was occupied by one of the Motos, was two-story. The store in front was one story, and then it had a large two-story annex in the back. And the Black Roadhouse was also two-story, rectangular building that, when you went inside, sort of reminded you of a Van Gogh painting. We went in. And you would go in through a front room, I suppose, probably a sitting room in the old roadhouse. This was built way back, well, not so far then, a half century back. And it had a pool table in the middle of it, and then there was a door over on the right hand side, and there were steps that led up to the rooms for rent, and I suppose some of the family's rooms upstairs. We went back into the kitchen and dining, combined kitchen and dining room, one big room with a family table. And Buddy Black, who was then 15 or so, showed us a specimen when we were talking about what we'd found, what Junior had found at the runway, and he showed us a harpoon head, which made hell you even more excited. It was an Aputac. Hell yeah, and I went back to the airfield, and hell yeah, told the boys to stop digging at the site. When you walk over there, there was taller than knee-high grass, fairly luxuriant grass growing out of this pure gravel, but along paralleling the backside of the runway, or the gravel beach that formerly was a visible log, a house log, obviously, that had been sheared off by the bulldozer. So hell, you knew that there was a structure there. And the boys went down the runway, Junior and the others, I've forgotten, they probably were going after to a site where Junior or where the other boys had found things before. We went back and were all very tired. I think we were probably our night and days were all mixed up, and went up and slept. Had something to eat at the Black's kitchen, and served by Mrs. Black, and I think sometimes the older kids were around, and Mr. Black was quite aged then. I imagine he'd lived in during many years by then, and in poor health, and he would sit nearby and talk, and the lady would wait on us at the table there. We went up in the upstairs. Each of us had our own room with that. It was just like going back many years. They had bunk beds, these were narrow bunk beds, and with a retaining board to hold in the mattress, and a single window with the light coming in. I recall the room was on the west side, and there was this light coming in through this old glass, smoky sort of light, and the smell of mildew, I suppose, of a room that wasn't heated year round and was mildewy. And I had a very hard time going to sleep, and apparently Helya did too. I was overtired and overexcited. So in the morning hours, July 27th. These are from the notes that I know at the time. It says 2 p.m., but I'm quite sure that it's a mistake. It was 2 a.m., but whatever, our days and nights were all totally confused. And we went down to start digging. Helya just looked around a little bit the day before, and we started digging alongside this south wall of what was to be the Khajgi. The notes said that we continued into late afternoon, so I'm it isn't conclusive the exact number of hours we worked there, but remember the digging was just spectacular. And the if you would expose the things under the gravel layer, that they would look like something that was just thrown out yesterday. It was remarkable. We rode up to Casa de Paga in the evening. We had with us it was a dump truck. Whether it had a dump capacity or not, it was a dump-like truck with a high, maybe built about 1939, I'd guess, perhaps a GM or a Ford, and a good-sized truck. And it seems to me that Puto Vestal drove it some of the time. I don't know. It had other drivers, too, but I remember seeing him driving it, and it usually had a load of people in it. I don't know whether they were road commission employees or whether they were just being taxied up to the mine. But we put all of our duffel and bags and rolled up tent and everything into the back of this big old truck and rode up river. I was impressed how beautiful it was. And as we passed what had been an old village a couple of miles inland, you could see remnants of graves and old cache structures, and you couldn't see much because of the houses, because there was quite a bit of brushy, low brush vegetation. That night, that evening and night mine, we stayed with at Don Stewart's house. The Casa de Paga was for me, I'd never seen a gold mining operation. It was very interesting, and we went over to the dredge, and the dredge man explained how they got gold, what would be now a tourist trip, and there was this constant clangor of machinery and people moving around. There were some men, I recall, digging a ditch of some kind. They're all Eskimos. Most of the labor was Inupiaq. And but the foreman and the chief mechanic and so on were Caucasian from outside. They came seasonally. The Inupiaq employees, which were the great majority, including cooking staff, were, I suppose, mainly during, but there may have been people from Candelaria or Buckland, I'm not sure on that, or even Kotzebue. In the cookhouse, or the cooks, I believe the cooks also had their rooms, private rooms. There was a small dining room, but it had at least two benches, bench tables that I can remember, and I suppose it would hold 20 or more men. The food at the mining camp was very adequate. Lots of it in good quality. As noted in the journal, that I had a good sleep and a meal at and slept overnight there. And Larson. The next morning, we went with Harry Outwater, who was a daring person, off to the road, main road again, and off on the little distance from the mining camp was an old building, unpainted wood, about the size of perhaps a large one car or a two car garage, and it had big doors that opened up in the front. And I remember that Harry opened up the door, and the bright sun. Light coming in on this scene. There was this old tractor. It looked, of course, you see, it probably was no more than 20 years old or 25 years old. But it was a gas cat, and it had was facing us with the crank you started with. It was faced outward, and it had heavy iron treads. It was really heavy built, but it wasn't a very big caterpillar, or it was like a tractor with treads, iron treads. And so it was really a caterpillar. And it took a little while to get it started cranking, and I don't know what else Harry had to do, but after a while he got this thing started and drove it out, clanking out from this old garage, and off to the side there was he ran it over, and there was a sled-like device that's called a Go Devil. It had a long channel iron sturdy tongue that you could attach to the cat, and it had no wheels. It had just heavy timbers. They probably had been greased to give them better traction. And then it had cross pieces and a bed on top of these sturdy timbers that were, of course, parallel to the treads of the tractor. So we loaded up all our stuff on this rather large bed. It must have been, oh, maybe 8 feet by 10 or 12 feet or something. Anyway, in my mind, it looks big, and it was well used, but still all in one piece. And Harry hitched the tractor to it. We put tied little ropes to tie things down, perhaps, and started off. And you had the choice, of course. The tractor moved along the gravel road that went up the Imnichuk farther up, and you had the choice of riding on the Go Devil, which was very hard riding, shake your teeth out if you had false teeth. And we went up along at a slow pace. You could walk a fast walk and keep up with the cat even on a good surface like the road. The old gas-fired Fordson cat was doing quite well once it got started, enough cranking and coaxing. And we went up, and as we went upstream, of course the river valley constricted, and there were tall willows, I recall, in places along the river and just growing. There may have been some alders too, and we'd come across old miners' cabins, houses, and at one point I remember we stopped just as we were starting to climb up on a branch, side branch, or a drainage, or the upper Imnichuk, and there on the left side or the east side of the road was a rather good number of old buildings, and they had been used at some time not too long before that. We went up and looked around, and I don't recall what Harry told us about the history of the place, but it had a dog barn. A feature of all these old roadhouses was a dog barn. It was, the roof was fallen in, but it, you could see where people had where they left their dogs when they were staying at this primitive roadhouse at night. And Harry told us that this was along the Nome Trail, that the Nome Trail took off from here, the one that went from Deering down to Nome, across the inland Seward Peninsula. And as we went along past this old camp, I remember there was a rather steep gradient from there on, and soon we were out of willows and into mat tundra, with dwarf birch up to your knees, and then pretty soon we were just on a very low mat tundra with just, you could put your hand in the cover with a few, blueberry bushes a little higher, and we came up onto sort of a rolling ridge or plateau, or you know, semi-plateau, it was broken by drainages down, so it was probably a ridge would be better. And Harry had been told by Taylor just what route to take, and as we went along, I remember seeing these old iron stakes sticking up. They were, many of them were bent, and those were the markers for the Nome, Deering, dog trail. As we went along with the cat, definitely you could keep up easily walking, so I would walk a ways, and hell, you mostly rode, and I walked and sort of ran. I'd let get ahead of me a little bit, and I'd run up and catch it. We were, of course, both wearing shoe packs. They're a bit heavy and hot, but that's the only thing we had to wear were shoe packs. And the cat climbed up, and we were then on this very low mat tundra, and it was becoming quite beautiful. He came across families of ptarmigan with the young were good sized, and they would run right away from where the cat was. Harry drove the cat along this ridge, and he didn't have a map with him, but he may even have been back there, but as I recall, he was advised by Taylor. We drove along this, and we were going somewhat, I'd say, southeasterly, and we came along the west side of this ridge until we were approaching Trail Creek, and Harry drove the cat right up. As we're going, I remember something interesting too. Right near the limestone or marble that that the ridge Trail Creek is composed of, and we came, and there was this amazing thing. Helya, I believe, took some pictures with it. He had his very fine German camera and a Leica, and he took pictures of this cone. It wasn't so much a cone, but a starburst or a flower. With pumice had been ejected, and it looked just like yesterday. There were no footprints. Nothing was displaced. The few lichens that were clinging to these sharp scoria or whatever they were, rocks, pumice or scoria, they were. There was just like you could have had an eruption there the day before yesterday. Of course, the excitement mounted as we knew that we were coming to the creek, but you don't know what to anticipate. We had no idea what things looked like, although Taylor had Helya talked to Taylor about the caves. I listened, but probably not as attentively. So we came and on the Cat, and Harry parked it headed southward, just on the ridge. Of course, we didn't know, none of us knew exactly where we were going to decamp, put up the tents. And we stopped somewhere short of the end of the ridge. Now, the right side or west side of the ridge just falls off fairly steeply, but there are few or any rocks that I remember being exposed. But when we walked up away on the ridge, and here was this breathtaking view out over the plateau, the lava flows of the plateau in the center of the peninsula, just spectacular. And then as we came over the top of the ridge, we looked down, and here were these sort of dizzying, at a dizzying angle, were the small pinnacles and remnants of crystalline limestone or marble. And we, at that point, we couldn't see any caves, of course, in the backside, but it was a very exciting time. So we started walking along, and there we did find caves. The one that we found on this top tier, we didn't go down all the way to the bottom at the creek, and and the caves are spotted all along from down near the its exit the creek exit there, Cottonwood Creek exits, the caves were spotted along the east facing slope, very steep slope of this ridge. Helya had Taylor Moto's description of the surroundings of Cave 2, and so the first within a few hours, with a short time period, we found Cave 2, the one that Larson has numbered Cave 2, and the one in which Taylor and his brother-in-law spent 5 days in 1928. After that, we unloaded the Go Devil. It was just a few tens of yards, or maybe 20 yards or meters, down and then around, and we looked for a place to set up the tent. We had looked for a place to set up the tent, and Helya reasoned that this rock shelter, or this old collapsing cave up the topmost, southernmost of the caves, would be a good spot, because we didn't have more than one tent, and we could use that for cooking. And so we brought our blazo box and boxes down to the cave 5, the one that's really only a shelter now. And despite its very flimsy, threatening nature, it looks as if it's going to fall on any moment, we decided to use it. It had a litter of rocks around. It wouldn't have been very good or very reassuring camping, but just to the right facing this topmost cave, southernmost. There's a small patch of ground that isn't quite flat, but it's less sloping than the remainder. And if you look in all directions, unless you were to get on the very top of the ridge, an exposed place and not very desirable from our perspective, there were no good ground. And this pertains to the cave area in general. That once you get down below the ridge, almost everything is a moderately or steeply sloping. So our tent, I believe, as I said, was 6 by 8. We put that up a few meters to the upstream or to the right of the cave mouth, and oriented it more or less the long axis with the stream. This meant that Helios slept, he was a rather tall man, so he slept up on the top side, and I slept on the bottom, as I recall. It was possible to fit in crosswise in the tent, so this, I know that I was, in both years, that I was on downslope in the tent, on that is the creek side, long wall of the tent. And then the door, or the flap of the tent, was oriented upstream. It worked out reasonably well. It wasn't a perfect camping place because of the slope, but it was probably as good as we could have done. And we did think about the water, and I believe that I said just previously that we didn't check out the cave from the stream. I don't think that we tried to survey all of the caves, but we were aware of where the snowbank would be the contributing factor, and we probably did go down. To go down from this campsite, there were two routes. One was a rather steep one up through a sort of a series of steep slopes and small talus or moss, secured rocks, which sometimes came loose, carrying a bucket of water, or to go around, which I always did with a few times I came up the other way, and it usually ended up spilling a third or more of the water. So I usually almost always went up around down this sort of little ridge that went down right to the stream bank as it turns westward out of the small canyon. Then I would walk the little ways to these eroded basins, stone basins, in which their water collected from the snow melt on the west-facing slope above us when we were down on the stream. And it was about, even with us when we were on the facing it from our tent area. At this point, I'd like to say something about the people who were involved and their relative importance. I believe I've alluded to, I've spoken of Helge's background in Denmark, and my own, I'll get to later. Harry Outwater, of course, was not as central, but he was very important because he drove the cat, and we got to know him a little bit and found him a very interesting person. He told us when I know that he stayed overnight before he went back with the cat, because that's the notes say so. Harry had stopped the cat pretty much directly above the area in which we put up our tent. It is uphill, and so it was not too much. The notes say that it was several hundred feet above Cave 4. That is, not in vertical distance, but in a foot distance. And Cave 4 maybe have other numbers, so it's the shelter, and no doubt has in various numbering systems, but it's the shelter cave with has a large wide shelter-like opening in front, and a very wide, like a ceilinged room, and then a small opening, relatively small opening, in the on the southwest corner, leading up uphill and out of this shelter. Harry stayed that night and told us. It doesn't say in the notes whether he tented with us. I assume he did. I suppose he could have stayed up slept on the Go Devil, but I don't remember that detail. He told us about his adventures in the Army in World War II, and how in 1945, the one thing that I remember outstanding about it was telling about going in the troop ship either around the world or all the way to India and back in the Pacific, and said that when he disembarked in this port city in India, he was utterly stunned, amazed to see that there were people in the world who were as poor as Eskimos, and that obviously made a great impression on him. He was not the only veteran. You might say Taylor was a veteran of concentration camps,